my favorite talks. And by the way, there's a set of videos out there called The Rocks Cry Out, and I took 3 years where I went all around the country with a young man your age, just out of school, a little older than you, and he worked full-time, and it took him a month from when we would film a 45-minute talk, a whole month of 40 hours a week working on it, to make these videos and add animation and add nature footage and add music and do all the editing and everything in order to make a 45-minute film. So it took us 3 years to make 18 of these talks. Now, in this week, you're only going to hear three of those 18 talks. The other three are new since I filmed those films, but this is one of them, and it's one of my favorites. Because as I've went around and talked in churches, lots of people, they're a little suspicious of the billions of years time frame, but they're really confused when they hear things like, the experts have studied the Egyptians, all of the experts, they've studied this Egyptian culture and the pyramids and the time frame, and they believe they were building those pyramids about 8,000 years ago. Or we'll hear that the Indians or Native Americans that were living in America before Columbus arrived in the 1400s, they arrived here about 12 to 15,000 years ago. That's how long people have been in America. Well, none of that fits a biblical time frame, and yet it seems so absolutely true, and there's so much evidence that seems to support archaeology and how old human beings have been around, but it doesn't fit everybody having spread across the earth after the flood of Noah. And I didn't really have the answers, so I spent a couple years studying how do you fit the Peruvians and the Incas and the Chinese and the Aborigines in Australia and the North American Indians. How do you fit them all into a biblical time frame? How does that even work? And it resulted in a book that I call Brilliant, Made in the Image of God. And the talk this morning is taken out of this book. And you're only going to see about 20% of the examples I have in this book of how incredibly intelligent these very early ancient cultures were and why there is such variety. Some cultures were really, really intelligent, while there were people that we call Neanderthals running around in Europe at the same time. And there's huge difference between the two. So we're going to discuss those things this morning. And as I said last night, the one place in Scripture that I've seen God emphasize things so strong because it was so important that he said it four times is when he told Adam, and it eventually made it into Scripture through Moses and down to us, that every one of us are made in the very image of the Creator of the universe. And I'm going to read that. This is Genesis 1, starting with verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. That's one. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the fowl of the air, the cattle, over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. That's two. In the image of God, he created them. That's three. Male and female, he created them. Actually, it's four because our own likeness is one also. So four times he said that. So we're going to think about that at the end of this lecture. But I want to start, and I think I saw this upstairs in the library area, so I think you're probably all familiar with this way of understanding history, which is reality. Huge events of God. The creation is one of them. I've already talked in the first talk about the fall of mankind was the next enormous interaction of God with humans. The worldwide flood we'll talk about on Thursday. And then the greatest event of all was that the one who made it all would take the penalty we deserve for our sin, literally become a human being. The deeper you understand that, the more absolute awe you will have of who God is. Today we're going to talk about all these cultures and how they arose in the time scale. And all of it points to Jesus' promise that he will return and creation will be returned to perfection and the enemy who is just distorting and lying about everything in a spiritual way. Satan is called the god of this air, of this world. He's not the big god, but he is powerful and deceptive and out to kill and destroy and lie. Well, we're going to look at number four. Now, let's just jump ahead. As we interact and deal with the world around us, they're thinking in a certain way. There has to be a way to explain, where do people come from? We're all here. We're intelligent. We're able to understand the world around us, but where did we come from? It's a foundational question every human being has to ask. And the world around us is being trained to think in a certain way because there are only two possibilities. One of those possibilities is if people didn't just suddenly appear, the only other option is that something turned into a person. Okay? If we didn't just instantaneously appear, then something turned into us. So you look around and you say, well, what in the biological world looks kind of the most like us? And they've come to the conclusion it's like apes and monkeys. Now, it's not just in the museums and it's not just in the textbooks. I think the most powerful influence in my generation on has been movies and cinema and the media. Everybody has a cell phone. Everybody can get onto the internet. And it's just everywhere. And Jesus taught in stories and parables for a reason. Stories stick with us. Facts and sermons that just involve instructions and facts, we forget a big part of it. But stories stick with us. And movies are stories on steroids. I mean, they have emotion built into them. They have moving images. They have music. They have sound. They have compelling emotional impact. So they really impact our thinking. Now, way back 10, 15, 20 years ago, all the people who spend their life watching and critiquing and understanding movies, they did a poll of the experts. What is the science fiction movie that has had the greatest impact on the thinking of people all over the world that's ever been made? Now, I was kind of surprised. I'm sure you've all heard of like the Star Wars movies and the Star Trek movies and all these science fiction movies, and I thought that would be it, but it wasn't. The one they picked, and I had watched it when I was young, was a movie called 2001, A Space Odyssey. Now, it's kind of a classic book. And actually, I don't know a lot of people that have watched it now because it was made 50 years ago. But in this movie, for the first 15 minutes, there was no talking, and it was just a portrayal of a bunch of apes running around, hitting each other with sticks, screaming, yelling, sleeping together, and just, like, doing stuff, okay, for 15 minutes, maybe 10, in that range. And then there's, like, this huge stone structure, and the sun brightly shines over it, and one of those apes has a thought, and the implication is there's this alien thing that has given some intelligent thought to this ape-like creature. And I want you to watch just 1 minute of this film, because this is the way the world is trained to think about where we came from. And it kind of shows how depraved the world around us is. That this is their image of why we exist. Watch this little clip. Okay, so here, according to this movie, is great, 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 great grandpa. Okay, there's grandpa. And he's just kind of digging around in the dirt. And you hear the crickets in the background. And here's this alien thing. And grandpa just got a thought. The first thought that ever entered his little monkey brain. And now it's a little dark. But he's looking at these bones. Now hear the music starting to build, okay? This is dramatic. He's looking at the bones. And he's thinking about the bones. Turn it down just a little bit. Okay, so now he picks one up and he's looking at it. Huh, wonder what I could do with this bone. And he kind of hits it on the ground. Oh, another bone moves. Wow, this is fun, says Grandpa. Hits it a little harder and it flies a little higher. He's going back and forth, hitting the bones with the other bone. Hits it again. Now he raises it higher, more force, and he pounds down. And they go flying. And his little monkey brain is starting to think, wow, what if I hit the skull with the bone? Maybe I could crush it. Maybe it would hurt. And he's discovered how to use a tool. Has it been his thought? Some alien has given him this thought. So now Grandpa, he can go and he can hunt and he can kill animals and he can learn to survive better. Now in this movie, he throws the bone up in the air and we fast forward a supposed 100,000 years and you see a spaceship starting to fly through the solar system and then it goes on to have this big adventure. Silly, absolutely fantasy. It's deception and deceit. But it's powerful in the way it's presented. And the thing is, that image, watched by tens of millions, just reinforced everything they're hearing in the schools and the textbooks, and it becomes reality to them. So don't just throw it off. One of my 18 talks is purely on this whole idea of apes having turned into humans, okay? I don't have time to do all my lectures, and I'm not doing that, but I'm going to take about 10 minutes at the end and show a little clip that just shows what an impossibility that is, because you need to know that. And we can't just hide, like an ostrich, stick our head in the sand, because we dig up skulls, and these are fully human bodies, smaller than us, in the rock layers, way up near the top of the rock layers. These are people that died after the flood, and slowly their bones were preserved. And their brains are half the size of ours. And sometimes their foreheads are sloped, more like monkeys. And these are found with tools and fire and little buildings that they've built. They're clearly intelligent, they're clearly human, but they look more apish than we do. And to pretend they don't exist and just say, that's just a conspiracy, it discredits the rest of our testimony. We as Christians can't just ignore what is the truth. We can't just ignore the evidence as if it doesn't exist. But we should have explanations for why it's being misinterpreted and misunderstood. And I'll just touch on that later. So here's the point. This is a way of viewing the past, okay? Something turned into us. But if that is true, the earlier the people, the further back you go, that means they had to have been much less intelligent. It means their building abilities would have been less developed. It means early cultures would have had languages that were just grunts and groans and meaningless little symbols. Their social structures were less developed. Their inventiveness would have been less. If that is true. So by studying archaeology, by studying the past, we can determine the truth. Because the other option is simply ignored. You are considered ignorant if you are to go into a college or talk to somebody who's been trained to think it only that way, and you say, I absolutely believe that one day in the past there were no people, and the next day there were two fully formed, fully functional, highly intelligent human beings here on earth. That's what God tells us, but people are trained to think in only one way, to ride their bike in only one way. They are blind to the idea that could not possibly be true. To them, that is fantasy. That is absurd. So they are left, they have to believe the alternative because they've eliminated the truth. But this is just one of these areas where we can now look at the past and say, what does it really show us? And it's really important. The focus of the next 50 minutes is man's knowledge of things that happened in the Garden of Eden. Not just from the Bible, but from other cultures. It shows up that they were aware of things that happened in the Garden of Eden. and his inventiveness and creativity and intelligence from the very start of civilizations. So we're going to look at some of those examples. Now, both the book and this lecture, brilliant. Mankind has been made brilliant. It just walks through history based on the timeline that we find in God's Word. Nowhere does it say on April 22nd of 4002 BC, creation happened, day one. There's nowhere to find that kind of date. But it says Adam was created, and everything that was made in a matter of literal, normal days. And then he lived so long and had a son, Seth, and Seth lived so long and had a son. And it goes all the way down to Noah, and you have about 1,600 years. And then from Noah to Abraham, there are the ages of people and how long they lived, and you have about another 500 years. And biblically, we know Abraham came to Egypt, left Ur, ended up in Egypt about 3,900 years ago. Moses was bringing the promised people into the promised land about 3,400 years ago. Jesus was born about 2,000 years ago. So you have about 6,000 years of history. If God is able to communicate, which I think he is, and if you're willing to trust what God's word actually says, you're stuck with that conclusion. But that seems ridiculous to the world around us. So we're going to see how all these cultures actually fit into that kind of time frame. Now, here's the problem. Essentially nothing, I'm telling you, nothing survived that flood of Noah. You had waves of water probably 1,000 feet deep, filled with boulders and sand and dirt and rubble, sweeping across entire continents at hundreds of miles per hour during that flood. There is no pyramid, there is no building, there are no hills that would have survived that. It literally scoured entire continents flat. And as those waves slow down, that sediment would drop out, and that's what's formed these rock layers we find all over the continents of the world. Total devastation. The Bible, God doesn't need to exaggerate. He just simply states fact. The world, the entire world, at that time was deluged and destroyed. And it's a understanding of total destruction when you really understand the language. But memories of what it was like before the flood and the things Adam would have heard from God as he was walking in the garden with him daily, God was telling Adam where it all came from and how creation happened and how long it took and so on. I think he would have written it down, and I think his sons would have protected it. And by the way, the sons of Adam overlapped with the life of Noah. That's how long people lived. So you would have had a direct one-generation separation from the creation of mankind to Noah. And I think Noah would have ended up with all sorts of knowledge, technology, and documents that he would have protected because he knew a total judgment of all mankind was coming. He wasn't dumb. He would have taken stuff with him. And these protected understandings of how to build and technology and not and mathematics and history would have been passed down and passed down and passed down, and I think is very treasured things, ending up in the hands of the most advanced civilization at that time, which was Egypt. And guess who's in Egypt in the temple? Moses. So I think that's probably logically where he got all this information we find in Genesis. It goes right back to the beginning. And it's speculation, but it's not all illogical. And after the flood, there would have been a rapid rebuilding of civilizations. And those who had the most knowledge would have built the most advanced civilizations. Those who were shut out for whatever reason, they were rapidly enslaved as workers. By prejudice, they were shoved to the less desirable areas to live. They would have just been trying to survive, eking out an existence with very little remembrance of the original knowledge. So you'd have this big disparity between different civilizations. Now, I want to give you an example that I think is absolutely stunning. I was just amazed when I first found this. I spent about 2 years working on this book, just sifting through really flaky stuff that, you know, with no documentation that probably wasn't true, and then finding these things that there was no doubt they were real. And one of them was a bronze sculpture that was dug up in the 1970s in China, in a province in China. And China is also one of the oldest civilizations upon the earth. And there's another one in the kind of the Pakistan-India region, which is one of the earliest civilizations. So basically, coming out of Noah, you had a civilization growing in Egypt, very early civilization. You had a civilization in India and another one in China that were very early, rapidly growing. And India and China are the most highly populated areas in the world, which makes sense if they're some of the earliest civilizations. Well, this is in a museum in China, and this is what it shows. It is, looks like this, made entirely of bronze. The folks who dug it up, and I have no reason to doubt them, they really believe it goes back at least 4,000 years. So this is a 4,000-year-old bronze casting. It's 12 foot tall, and it's got branches with leaves on the branches. But the interesting thing is, the leaves are shaped like knives with a fruit nestled in amongst the knives. Here's what they look like. See, they're kind of a sharp, knife-like shape surrounding a fruit. And to me, that's kind of symbolic of a dangerous tree or a forbidden tree with a fruit there in amongst the tree. Okay? Next, there is a snake at the bottom of the tree. And interestingly enough, this is a very evil, mean-looking snake, and it still has, like, legs, okay? Snake-like creature with legs at the bottom of a tree with forbidden fruit. Anybody, like, noticing some similarity here? Now, remember, this is 4,000 years old. Moses wasn't even born yet. They did not have the Bible or any sort of scriptures. But they came from the sons of Noah, and knowledge of what was happening before the flood would have went with them. And then last, there's a human hand reaching up toward the fruit. Isn't that interesting? You know, four fingers, thumbs, knuckles, fingernails. So you have a human reaching toward forbidden fruit on a tree where there's a snake at the base of the tree. 4,000 years old in China. See, people worldwide started out with a knowledge. And the one thing the first Chinese did not want the next generation to forget, why does sin and death and despair and sorrow exist upon this planet? Because we rebelled against God, and he brought judgment upon us. They didn't want them to forget that. And there's a 12-foot sculpture memorializing that real event that happened in Earth history. It is stunning, and the world is blind to it. Now, it's not just there, the Chinese language itself. As people spread out from Babel, and in dozens and dozens of different languages, they couldn't even communicate with each other. People are so brilliant, they immediately started to assign meanings to some sort of symbols so they could capture knowledge and pass it on to the next generation. And the Chinese did exactly that. Now, they had tons and tons and tons of symbols. The original language, and I'll tell you in a moment how many symbols there were assigned to meanings. The first one here on the page, I know some of you can't read it, it's real small, it's called anger. Now this is funny. The second one is called diarrhea, which means they got to have the third one, which means toilet, okay? And on and on and on and on, okay? And here's some ancient bones they found. The original Chinese symbols were much more complex than the modern ones. Mao took over China, murdered hundreds of millions of people, got rid of all the intellects. One of the things he did do was simplify the language, so now there's not as many, but you go back to the original language, there were 80,000 symbols. And you had to know what each one meant. I mean, that's like our letters. Imagine singing the alphabet song to your child at night. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, except you have 80,000 of them. And think how brilliant you have to be to know what every single one of these means. These people weren't stupid. Now, I want to show you a few of them because there are hundreds of them that missionaries over there have written books and showed that they literally are tied to biblical events. And I'm just going to show you two. The Chinese symbol for garden looks like this, okay? But it's a combination of other symbols. This little upside down T thing right here means dust. That one alone, if they see it, they know it means dust. The little square right here underneath of it means breath or life. This K kind of thing means two people. And the big rectangle surrounding it means an enclosure. So dust, given breath, made two people in an enclosure. And you put it all together, it means a garden. Isn't that amazing? That, no way could that be happenstance. When they developed their language, they knew about the Garden of Eden, and they wanted their symbols to reflect what happened there. Second example, the very symbol for boat is a vessel, something that could, you know, keep water out or retain water, with eight people on board. So eight people on a vessel is a boat. Where in history were there eight people on a vessel? Noah and his wife, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives, eight people. Why not two? Why not 10? Why not 20? Because they knew about Noah's flood. See, all of this is reality, and the world around us is blind to it. These are facts of history and observation. Now, I'm just going to kind of jump a little side view to give you another form of writing that kind of stunned me as I was looking at history. I actually went to Peru to study and get pictures and information on a lot of this stuff in Peru, because Peru goes back really, really old too, easily 3,500 years. They have no form of writing. When the Spanish showed up, there was no paper, no symbols, no form of writing. But what they noticed were people making these things that are called quipuses. Here's what they look like. It's a long rope with a bunch of other cords dangling from it. And based on, you know, ancient 500-year-old documents, there were just thousands and tens of thousands of these. Well, each of these cords have knots tied in them, and each of the cords are a different length, and they're all placed in a specific order along the quipus. So depending on the number of knots, the position of the knots, the location of the knots, how long the cord are, it's like you're writing a letter. An A may be a knot halfway down the cord. A B might be a knot halfway down the cord, but the cord twice as long, or whatever. You're just assigning a meaning to that cord. So someone will sit there, he'll tie the cords, he'll tie it on, he'll do the next one, he'll do the next one, he'll do the next one. He'll roll it up, he would put it inside of a bamboo pole. And the Incas had a highway that would run all the way from New York to Los Angeles, 2,000 miles long, up and down over top along the ridge of the Andes Mountains. They'd hand somebody one of these, they would run for 20 or 30 miles in a day, hand it to another runner who would run another 20 or 30 miles, and in about 10 days, they could take a message from one end of the kingdom to the other. Someone would open it, pull it out, unroll it, and read it just like we could read a newspaper. Isn't that cool? It's a really inventive way to write. Shows the creativity and intelligence of people all over the world. Now, that's all I'm going to talk about for those first 1,600 years of human history. You get a few more clues in the Bible and how everything deteriorated and evil took over and there was absolute murder and mayhem everywhere. And only Noah remained righteous. But I want to talk next about the next era of Earth history. What was happening for the next 400 or so years? Because when Noah landed, I mean, this earth was a mud flat. Every tree had been ripped up. Every blade of grass was gone. They floated around as vegetation mats as the waters abated and the land rose, and there's a natural process that would make that happen during the flood because the continents are less dense. They're less heavy than the ocean basins. So as at month, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, you start to get this settling of the oceans and rising of the continents and the water would rush off. And by the way, people say, well, there's no way the animals from the ark could have survived. You know, they wouldn't have anything to eat. Well, I tell them, have you ever grown a garden? When you plant things in the garden, does it take 10 years before you start to get something? Matter of fact, if you don't weed it and take care of it within about 2 months, it's all weeds. It's total vegetation. So the whole world would have been covered with seeds and stuff that just settled down from floating vegetation. And trees and plants and stuff would have started to grow very, very rapidly. But it still took months because Noah sent out a raven and it didn't come back with anything. And it did it again, didn't come back with anything. And the dove finally came back with an olive. But it wasn't a full-grown tree, but it showed there was vegetation growing to the point where the animals could survive. But it only took months, not years. But they're struggling for a foothold. Hundreds of years passed to the Tower of Babel because there was an enormous number of people that broke into dozens and dozens of groups of languages that spread out. And that just didn't happen in 10, 20 years. I don't know how long, but it was probably hundreds of years. And by the way, we totally disobeyed God. He said to spread out and fill the earth. And instead, mankind gathered and hunkered down under one leader. And we're building a tower to reach to heaven. Why? Because God promised there would never be another flood, but I suspect we didn't trust him. I don't think we can comprehend how traumatic this was to go through that flood and wonder every day and every week if you weren't trusting God, is it going to happen again? Is it going to happen again? And I think that's what the Tower of Babel was. It was a total distrust in God in trying to protect ourselves under our own means, which never works. And this is where the Ice Age fits in. The Ice Age was a real event in Earth history. And one of the artifacts I'm going to show you testifies to that Ice Age and what was happening. But it probably started lots of evaporation from warm ocean water after the flood, caused rainfall, much wetter climate worldwide, but come snowfall in the north and the south, and it just built up and built up and built up into enormous glaciers. And it wasn't until the oceans cooled down and the evaporation slowed down that most of that ice started to melt and flow back into the oceans. But that's where it fits. Probably a 1,000-year period we had an ice age building and then declining. So let's just jump in to this period of Earth history, immediately after Noah lands. And I'm going to first look at ancient Egypt because they really have the most artifacts. We have the most knowledge about Egypt of any other ancient culture. And it was a huge civilization. Before I get there, I want to talk biblically about it. As I said, you can look through the various dates that the Bible allows us to figure things out. And right around 3,900 years ago is when Abraham would have arrived in Egypt. And if you remember, he didn't totally trust God either. He was afraid he would be murdered and his wife be stolen. So he pretended his wife was his sister, and Pharaoh took her as a wife, and judgment came upon Pharaoh, and he was thrown out of the land. And so he should have just trusted God, but he didn't. But God worked it all out. Mankind would have been highly motivated to have very large families. I mean, there's only 8 people on the planet. You don't want to just have 2 kids. And they lived much longer. So I want you guys to think about this. By the way, God blesses children. And one of the travesties of our culture is that most people nowadays only have 1 or 2 kids. That's the norm. Because they're too busy gathering possessions and thinking about themselves instead of realizing what a blessing children are. When I grew up, 8-10 kids was very, very normal. And not just in strong religious communities like yourself, but across the culture. What do you think the record is? Because I want to give you a perspective of what was happening long ago. What do you think the record is for a single mother having the most children? How many children do you think she had in her lifetime? And this is in good documented historical times. So this one goes back a couple hundred years. And it's kind of an amazing, stunning number. But what do you think? Throw out a number. Just shout it out. 26, too low. 43, too low. Very close. The record is 69 children from one woman. Okay? Now, she was probably, as soon as she had a baby, she had with us again, expecting another one. She had multiple twins and triplets, probably pregnant from when she was 14 until 54. But that's what happened. See, that's what's possible with our lifespans. And these people were living hundreds of years. So if we, you know, if you go on the internet, they document at least 50 women with 20 or more children. So I'm going to make an assumption. And by the way, people lived longer. They were healthier. The Earth's magnetic field was stronger, which keeps away more harmful rays from the sun. All sorts of reasons people had longer lifetimes. But let's just figure this out. Suppose the three couples that came off of the ark over 50 years, and remember, they lived about 400. But so let's just say over 50 years, they had 20 kids. They probably had way more. So that's a very conservative starting point. That means 50 years after the ark landed, there would be 68 people on the earth. The original couples each had 20, that's 60 more plus the original 8. 50 years later, those children partner up, and they each have 20. Now you have 600 people on the earth plus the originals. 150 years later, you have 3,000 couples. 200 years later, you have 30,000 couples. Let's assume the Tower of Babel happened at this point. You have 66,000 people on the earth. Now, this is just, you got to pick some numbers to come to some conclusions. It's probably not right. There probably were more. In Genesis, it lists a table of nations that came out of Noah and his children and his grandchildren, and it lists 20 different nations that developed. So let's just assume there were 20 different languages and 20 different groups headed out. 66,000 divided by 20 means, there's 70. Divided by 70 means there was, each group would have had about 400 couples. So 400 or so couples, 800 or so people moved to Egypt. Well, now, 4,100 years ago, we're 250 years after the flood, those couples each have 20 kids. Now you have 4,000 couples in Egypt. 50 years later, 42,000. 4,000 years later, 400,000, 3,950. About the time Abraham arrives in Egypt, there could have been 42 million people living there. You see, it all makes total sense. Now, I don't think there probably were, because mankind's always been sinful. Some people were being enslaved. There was murders going on. Some people may not have as many children. Lifetimes were dropping off. But it's totally reasonable, based on what God tells us, that there would be an incredible, large, advanced civilization in that area at that time. The world around us is the one with the bigger problem. Why aren't there way, way, way more people if civilizations go back 20, 30, 40,000 years? There should be way more stuff out there, and there's not. So we have the truth on our side. Looking at Egypt, for 3,600 years, and I believe that Great Pyramid was built right in the 4,000-year-ago range, and we started building high, tall skyscrapers and stuff in the 1800s. So even if it was built 3,800 years ago, that was the tallest building on the planet built by human beings for 3,600 years. And here's what it looks like. Now, it contains 2.3 million blocks. They estimate it weighs 5 billion pounds. It's made from limestone. The limestone was cut into blocks, and they find all sorts of rubble and stuff to support this, 500 miles away. So they had to move each block 500 miles to put it in position to build this pyramid. All of the experts and the historians say it took about 20 years to build this pyramid, because the pharaoh that commissioned it was a young man, and he died 20 years later, and this was to be his tomb. So if you divide 20 years by 2.3 million, and you can do this with your phone, so 2.3 million divided by 20, and then there's 365 days in a year, so that number divided by 365, and there's 24 hours in a day, so that number divided by 24, it turns out they would have had to put one of those stones in position every 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, another 6 foot by 4 foot by 5 foot stone put in position. 5 minutes later, another one. 5 minutes later, another one. Every day, 24 hours a day for 20 years to get them all in position to build that pyramid. I don't think we could do that today. But at the very beginning of human civilizations, they were able to construct that project. Isn't that stunning? That's the brilliance that was brought with them through the flood of the people who had the technology to do these sort of things. And then they laid these huge 8-foot-long capstones that were smooth on the surface, and they had a stair-step pattern underneath of them. They covered the whole pyramid with these smooth stones so that from 30 miles away over the curvature of the earth, you could see this gleaming white pyramid structure standing up above the earth. Stunning archaeological achievement. But to make it, they had to level a base that was within 0.001 inch difference every foot. It had to be that level. We have to send something to a computer-driven milling machine in order to make that sort of accuracy when we make metal things in the shop. They did it over a 14-acre flat ground. Because if it went up and down, those blocks would have went up and down, and the whole thing would have been out of tilter, perfectly level. And this is even more stunning. The Great Pyramid is exactly 1/3 of the way from the North Pole to the equator. It's a position called the prime meridian on the planet, and it's a really important astronomical spot. To know where that spot is on the globe, you have to know the diameter of the globe with incredible accuracy in order to place something in that position. And you have to know the globe is round. And they decided to align it perfectly north-south with the magnetic field of the Earth. The points of that pyramid are within 2% of a single degree on the compass. 3,600 years later, we built an observatory in London, England, called the Greenwich Observatory, and we tried to align with all of our compasses and technology and modern mathematics, we tried to align that building perfectly north-south. We were 6% off. So at the beginning of civilization, they were way better with technology than we are today. Stupid ape-like creatures eking out an existence, it doesn't fit. Made in the image of God, incredibly intelligent human beings, the evidence supports it. So we have the truth. At the same time, those first few hundred years after that, we had human beings trying to survive an ice age with no technology. This is probably a pretty good artist's rendition of these people, but they are 100% human. They were really, really intelligent, and I'll show you that in a moment. But I suspect there's prejudice. They were probably laborers, and they were pushed to the fringes of civilization where it wasn't as pleasant to live. You had an ice age raging in Europe. It's cold. There's lots of snow. The best place to live is probably going to be in caves, and you're trying to survive. And you had another group of people without a lot of technology. They lived in ice age Europe, but they cared for the elderly. They buried people with valuable artifacts, spears and shields and clothing. They could have used that stuff to survive, but they put it in a grave with their dead. Because even these people knew there was something after this life. And that's their way of preparing their dead for that. They hunted in coordinated parties to bring down woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. And this was really cool. There was a research report I came across, and it said, Neanderthals invent super glue. They had found that these guys had glued these big spearheads to the end of their wooden shafts, and then they'd wrapped it with rawhide. But the glue was so strong, 4,000 years after they were made, that when they tried to pull off the spearhead, the wood would break before the stone would pull away from the wood. So they started analyzing it and trying to figure out how did they do this. They figured out what the glue was made of. It was made from a tree resin, but you had to take this sticky tree resin and you had to heat it up to about 650 degrees and you had to hold it there for exactly an hour. And if it was 700 degrees, it would just char. If it was 600 degrees, it wouldn't cross-link. It had to be exactly that temperature. If you held it too long or too short, it wouldn't work. So they tried to reproduce it, okay? They tried to make the same glue. And everything they tried wouldn't work. They figured, well, these guys probably didn't have technology, so they would put the resin under a stone and put a fire over the stone and try to get it to cross-link just right, and they just failed every time. They finally succeeded by putting a modern electronic thermocouple down there and measuring the temperature and then watching the fire and keeping track of it. So the point is, using all of our built-up knowledge over 4,000 years and modern technology, we were finally able to achieve what these guys did without all of that technology early on. So who's really the smartest person? These guys, just human beings living in a tough spot, but they were really, really smart and really artistic. They had enough spare time to paint these beautiful drawings on these cave walls. Just herds of horses and animals and all sorts of stuff. Here's a picture of a pride of lions, and it's three-dimensional. That wall comes out like this far, and it's only by looking at a certain angle you can see all of the lions lined up on the wall. Just really, really artistic. Here's another one in South Africa, and so on. So that's early on. Some advanced civilizations, some just eking out an existence. What's going on for the next 4,000 years of Earth history, from 4,000 to 3,000 years ago? This period's characterized by massive building projects. You have that ice age that near the end of this period is coming to an end, and as the oceans cool down and cool down and cool down, you're going to have like a rapid climate change. It's going to go from a wet, rainy, snowy climate worldwide to whole areas of the Earth just drying out as these rainstorms end and desert areas forming. This is one of those, another stunning thing that's been discovered and never been explained by the modern world. They just ignore it. This is a map on a sheepskin that was discovered in the 1700s called the Pyrrhus map. It's believed to go back 3,800 years of Earth history. The map was found and the information was compiled in 1513. Now, the source of the information on this map was probably the Library of Alexandria. The Library of Alexandria was shortly after the time of Jesus in Alexandria, which is on the coast of the Mediterranean. And that library was known to have had over 1 million scrolls of information. It burned down about 100 years later, and most of that information was lost. But you'll see the notes at the bottom of this map. See all these little footnotes? Now, here's a coastline with a bunch of islands. Here's a big island, lots of little islands, and a very, very craggy coastline. This is the coastline, the actual land of Antarctica. Okay, you can just lay this map right against where we now know the land of Antarctica to be, and it's going to match up. The trouble is, Antarctica is totally covered with ice. And right at the edge of where this land hits the water, the ice is about 2 miles deep. The ice actually goes out as much as 100 miles out beyond that surface of the land. And for all documented human exploration, it's been covered by ice. So nobody we know of has ever seen the coastline of Antarctica. But this map shows where the coastline is at. Every modern textbook says the Ice Age began about 200,000 years ago and ended about 10,000 years ago. So this has been covered by ice for the last 200,000 years. And even after the Ice Age ended, it's still covered with ice in that area of the world. So humans weren't around 200,000 years ago. How could they know where that coastline is? Huge mystery. And by the way, these footnotes say this area was a warm, temperate area. Antarctica, a warm, temperate area. So people just ignore this map and pretend it doesn't show what it shows. In the book, I document, it was sent to the cartography department of the United States Air Force in the 1960s. And the United States Air Force looked at it, compared it, because we have done radar mapping of where that land is underneath that ice, and we now know. And they said, this map definitely shows where the coastline is. We have no idea how this could ever have been drawn in 1500. Total mystery. Well, here's the biblical answer. Shows this accurate extent, described as a warm climate. This is what it looks like. The land surface is way back here, like 10 or 50 miles, or in places even 100 miles back, totally covered with ice. This is what was going on after the flood. the motions were much warmer, lots of land movement, volcanism during the flood. There was mass extinctions. That's what laid down all the fossils, deposited the rocket, the rocks. It guaranteed there was an ice age because of all this evaporation for hundreds and hundreds of years. As the water evaporates, and think of how long you have to boil water in a pan for all that water to turn into gas. You've got to pour a lot of heat into it. As the water is evaporating, it's pouring heat out of the oceans, but the oceans are huge. The skies would have been cloudy for centuries, which would have reflected more of the sun's heat, and snow would have built up. But the oceans themselves remain warm. So around the coastline, snow is falling further inland, but you have water down there in Antarctica that might be 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It's like the Bahamas or Florida, really, really warm along the coast, cold further inland. This is a map of what the ice looked like at the peak of the Ice Age. I mean, ice built up 2 miles thick, trillions and trillions of tons of weight, shoving that ice forward all the way down into the Tennessee Valley, Ohio Valley, covering parts of Montana. But along the coasts up here along the Bering Sea, along the coasts of Alaska, along the coasts of Siberia, even though this area is as flat as that area, the warm ocean water kept ice from forming along those areas. Same thing down here in Antarctica. So people after the flood, I'm going to skip past this. People after the flood would have been exploring the planet. They wanted to know what it look like now. They were able to build boats. They documented the coastline of Antarctica before it became permanently covered with ice and the oceans froze over. Those documents were passed down and passed down and passed down. They probably ended up in the Library of Alexandria. Some of those were probably saved. Eventually, even in the 1500s, someone found it and reproduced it. So we have a very good biblical explanation for how that map could exist. The world around us is clueless. The evidence fits God's word. Building projects worldwide. In Peru, they built these walls, and these are way older than the Incas and the Mayans. They would build these walls for temples that are shaped like a jigsaw puzzle. They go up and around and down, and they curve, and they fit so tightly, you can't even fit a credit card between these. They're almost watertight. And some of these stones weigh close to 500,000 pounds. We don't know how they build them. No idea how they made these structures. Look at the size of that stone compared to a person, all cut intricately to fit into these other stones. Huge blocks. These blocks probably weigh 1,000,000 pounds, and they've been moved up over top of a mountain and back down and placed into position. We don't know how they would have moved it without crushing rollers. They wouldn't have rolled on rollers. Somehow they moved them dozens of miles to get them to where they are. Brilliant, brilliant people. In America, the Native Americans preceding all of the modern Indian tribes, the folks built these huge burial mounds all over Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and they're believed to be 3,000 or more years old. Well, in 1910, an archaeologist dug stuff out of these mounds, and he documented it in a book, and you can still find his book on the internet. And he has pictures of 31 original either slate or copper plates that were dug out of these mounds. And here's they're looking for treasure. These are like grave robbers digging into these Indian mounds. Often they look like serpents. Look at this. That's 3,000 years old. A culture in America built that. We don't necessarily know why, but there's a fascination with snakes by ancient cultures. What did Satan come out? A snake. So there's that fascination. Here's another one in southern Ohio. Here's a mound in Marietta, Ohio. But here's one of the plates that was pulled out of that mound. Now check this out. You've got kind of hieroglyphics like the ancient Egyptians. So it's the same time period as the Egyptians. Then you've got a literal picture of people drowning, a huge vessel with something, some sort of a thing along the top. And then 1, 2, 3, 4 men raising their hand in worship as animals come off that vessel. Found in an Indian mound in Ohio. Now, this is really controversial. The secular world will say it's a fake. And honestly, there's no way of knowing. It could be a fake, but it also could be real, and we have a reason for believing that. So it's not kind of definitive proof, but I think it's really, really interesting. So just a few more. I'm going to jump quickly past a few of these. This is in Peru. They were elongating people's skulls. And there's stones buried in tombs that go back 3,000 years that show them doing brain surgery and heart surgery on people. I don't know why they liked people with pointy heads, but they did. So they would take priests and royalty, and they would strap boards so that their skull could only grow backwards. And they would deform the skulls of young children until they had that shape all their life. Check that out. But you had to know a lot about anatomy and human physiology to do these sort of things. And here it shows them doing brain surgery on a what's called an Ica stone. It's been buried in a tomb and etched into a rock. And we find skulls. Here's two of them in a museum I went to. There's a gold plate placed into this person's head that had a hole cut, the bone pulled away, and the bone has grown back around the plate. So he survived perfectly. Here's a round gold plate with the bone. You can see the bone tissue has refused to the plate. They have found hundreds of these, brain surgery over 2,000 years ago. In ancient Greece, in the year 2000, Time magazine decided we're going to have the year of the man of the millennium. Every year they have the man of the year on their magazine cover. They wanted to do a poll and say, what is the human being from the year 1000 until the year 2000, in that 1,000-year period, most impacted and advanced human knowledge and life? Did the most good of any person? And I'll often ask people to throw out, and they'll say, well, maybe Albert Einstein or Da Vinci or Michelangelo. The one that was picked who most helped human beings was Johann Gutenberg. Anybody remember what Gutenberg did? The printing press. Because for the first time in human history, we were told, now we can take knowledge, we can make little letters, put them in a tray, put ink on it, run paper across it, and we make copy after copy after copy after copy, and we can spread knowledge across humanity, and we won't lose information and knowledge from one generation to the next. That's what drove the reformation of Christianity from the distortions of Catholicism, was the printing press. And the Bible was the first book ever printed on the printing press. That's what drove the scientific revolution that allowed, and the Industrial Revolution that allowed the advancement of all the technology we have today. It was the printing press. But Gutenberg didn't invent it. In Greece, 3,100 years ago, they found a disc. This is in the National Museum in Athens, Greece, that has a bunch of little symbols that have been pressed into clay because they put these little hardened symbols in a tray. So copy after copy after copy of this information could be made. Exactly the same technology. 3,000 years before Gutenberg. So it was the discovery of typesetting, preceded Gutenberg by 2,500 years. And it was its rediscovery that transformed the modern world. But mankind already had it. They were already doing it. Isn't that interesting? Mankind has always been highly intelligent. I'm going to jump past this one. They were creating 6,000-pound marbles in Costa Rica 3,000 years ago. You don't know why. There's thousands of them. And they found some of them 300 miles offshore on other islands from stones that were dug up in Costa Rica. But you look in all the textbooks, they say back then, 3,000 years ago, they only had little dugout canoes. How are you going to load a 10,000-pound rock into a dugout canoe and paddle it 300 miles offshore? They had technology way back then. It's just all been lost. So common, they're used as lawn ornaments. Oh, 30,000 pounds. Okay, real quick, because I'm out of time. Lots more in the book. They had batteries in ancient Iraq. Though that is a battery. It's in a clay jar, but it's got a cathode and an anode and a copper tube, and it was filled with an electrolyte. And it's believed they used them for electroplating. We find metals so thin on some of the artifacts they haven't been able to figure out how they got there. They were doing this way back then. Okay, this is the last example. 2,100 years ago in Greece, back in 2001, they found a shipwreck. They collect all the pottery and the coins, and they threw this encrusted, coral-encrusted piece of junk on the shelf in 1901. Well, in 1971, some researchers pulled it out, and they started x-raying it, and they found it was the intricate arrangement of 82 bronze gears, all intricately connected. And they couldn't figure out what in the world, over 2,000 years ago, were they building out of all these gears. They spent, well, I'm sorry, 30 gears, but there were 82 fragments. But they realized it was an astronomical computational computer used to plot the position of things in our solar system. This report came out in 2006, so they spent 35 years studying this thing, 72, 82, 92, 102, 35 years. And when the report came out from Cardiff University up in Canada, this was the quote from the team leading, trying to figure out how this thing worked. He said, "This device is extraordinary. The only thing of its kind, its design is beautiful, and its astronomy is exactly right. The mechanics are designed to make your jaw drop open. Whoever did it extremely carefully. In terms of historic and scarcity value, it's more valuable than the Mona Lisa," which, by the way, is worth about $100 million or more. This is what they think it looked like. It was in some sort of a box that's rotted away. It had two handles on the outside and a series of pointers that pointed to things. And on the back, it had a series of pointers that pointed to years and months with a series of rings coming around it. What you could do is turn the dials till on one side you pointed to any day of any year. You could go 500 years in the past, you could go 500 years in the future. Then on the back, in those concentric rings, it would tell you where in the sky you could find Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter, the visible planets. I mean, how many of you think you could build that? I could spend my life and not figure out how to do that. They were doing it 2,000 years ago. And if they could do it then, I suspect there's a lot of other things they could do, and there was more than one of them. They've just lost them all. Here's where I want to end up with this sermon, this lecture. Why have we lost all that technology? Why did the whole world go into the Dark Ages? Why did the Greeks lose the ability to transfer information by a printing press type process? It's because they left out a source of truth and information, and they started just thinking of themselves. Every time we leave God, and every time we leave the knowledge God has given us out, everything becomes relative and the focus becomes upon ourselves. And it happens in every civilization that's ever been upon this planet, because at their root, mankind is sinful. Morality degenerates. The most powerful, the most convincing, the most devious gravitate toward being in control of cultures. It's just what happens. Life becomes cheapened because you can get more if you can force other people to do your will, and every society ultimately falls apart. And with it is lost the knowledge. And by the way, it's happening in America. We think it could never happen here. It's happened throughout history. In this book, I end with this page that says, "Mankind made in the image of God." And I speculate, what does it mean when it says we're made in the image of God? And I've talked about one of them now. The creativity of people is astounding. The music, the art, the designs, the cities, the way to interact with people. Our ability to communicate. There's nothing else. Apes don't even come close. It's like a gulf between us and the moon, the difference between our ability and any other animal's ability to communicate, and assign meaning to symbols to preserve that communication. Of all created creatures, we have the ability to be compassionate, to have empathy, to care and love. Animals don't have any compunction of wiping out any other animal. it doesn't give them a thought. Their only ability to survive is with God has given them that ability and the ability to choose. Animals are ruled by instinct. We have the ability to obey or not obey, to choose the truth or reject the truth. But I think it's really important to get the truth in front of people. And I hope this talk has helped to fit all of human endeavor and all of human existence into a biblical perspective with examples of how we've always been intelligent. And when we find those ape-like creatures and those stone tools and all that stuff, those were just people trying to survive in a very, very hard environment. That was what this world was right after the flood. And we're misinterpreting them as some sort of ape turning into a person. And there was things called degeneration. Things do degenerate. Certain cultures and groups, if they're starved and they're interbred and brothers and sisters, after more and more and more and more mistakes build up, keep breeding together and breeding together, it will literally degenerate the human body, brain, mind, and size. So we start to look more like apes. And that's some of the things that were happening after the flood and how all that fits in. So, now, I'm really looking forward to questions, which is tomorrow. So if I've said things in any of these lectures and you have thoughts and you're wondering how it fits together, make sure you remember it, write it down, ask me either verbally or put it in the box, because we'll talk about all those kind of things tomorrow. All right? Thank you. You don't have to clap.